statement for the Palestinians.
What about your gaffe?
Governor Romney, do you feel that your gaffes have overshadowed your foreign trip?
Holy sight for the Polish people. Show some respect.
Governor Romney, just
show some respect.
We haven't had another chance to ask him questions.
This is a holy sight.
Welcome to the Holy Sight edition of It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. And holy mackerel, were those real journalists yelling at Mitt Romney?
Yes, they were. In fact, they were some of the leading lights of the American political journalistic community who are following regularly the Romney campaign.
Okay, now I understand. I understand that Romney is not answering questions and he's not making himself available, but that did sound...
like a Saturday Night Live parody of journalists.
It did.
It sounded like a bunch of reporters... actor reporters.
Fake reporters.
Trying
like
to
us.
Parody. Trying to parody us. No, I mean, it was pretty bad. And you can sort of understand why Rick Gorka, who is the Romney person you hear admonishing these reporters, has gotten very frustrated. And, of course, he tells them to kiss him. And then he also says
kiss part of his body.
Shove it. And so on. It gets a little vulgar, which, of course, was why we were attracted to having it in the podcast.
Right, and which is what the kind of thing you'd say at a holy site anyway.
And so he, of course... is forced to apologize to these people later on. And it gets to be this whole sort of deal that overshadows the rest of the day that former Governor Romney spent there in Poland visiting a World War II memorial, a tomb of the unknown Polish soldier, and so on. And that really became the news of the day, that final day that Romney was on his otherwise not exactly triumphant tour.
I was going to say that really marred his trip because everything was going so well in Britain when he talked about the British unpreparedness for the Olympics. Then going to Israel,
In Israel, really. I mean, he gets caught up in what is, let's face it, a complete quagmire language-wise in trying to talk about the issues between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And he tries to find a way to answer the question of why the Israelis have been so much more successful in this part of the world than the Palestinians. And he attributes it to cultural differences. Well, that...
nothing about trade restrictions or any, or a closing of the borders.
Totally sets off all the partisans, gets the Palestinians upset, gets all kinds of commentators back in the United States calling him a racist. And,
well, no. It was the Palestinian Authority that called him a racist.
Well, and so did some commentators in the United States as well. And picking up the line, perhaps, from the Palestinian Authority. But he gets himself right into the complete maelstrom of controversy that is the Middle East.
What's so odd about this is that, to me, Mitt Romney is running a very risk-averse, disciplined campaign that every time there is a gaffe like this, and there have been more than several by either him or somebody speaking for Mitt Romney, it's shocking to me because he's so, as I say, disciplined. You think that he just knows exactly what to say and what not to say, and when he comes out with words like culture or the unpreparedness of the Brits and things like that.
Or how about this example from when he was in Israel?
It's a deeply moving experience to be in Jerusalem, the capital of Israel.
Okay, well, that seems an innocuous enough thing to say. That seems like a perfectly respectable thing to say, except...
If Jerusalem were the capital of Israel. But a lot of people, especially evangelical Christians, feel that Jerusalem should be the capital. It is the historic and holy capital of Israel.
And it's the official position of the Israeli government that they want to have the capital be Jerusalem. But at this moment, it is still Tel Aviv.
The whole Romney candidacy and his views on the state of Israel seem to be at odds with previous presidential candidates, certainly previous presidents, who basically their role was to be an honest arbiter between the Palestinians and Israel in peace. But how does Romney play that role as president when he's clearly a cheerleader for Netanyahu?
Well, I would say that the only serious element in all of the bad publicity that Mitt Romney got in the three stops on this tour was the fact that he had made it so difficult for him to be seen as in any sense objective about the Israeli conflict or about the Middle East conflict.
Which is fine for him, right?
It's fine for him in the primary campaign. It's probably fine for him in the general election campaign because he's trying to maximize his appeal to Jewish voters, particularly in Florida. And a couple
Christian
of
evangelicals.
Other, that's right. I think he's got the Christian evangelical vote, those who are not bothered by his Mormonism. But I think he's got that vote pretty well. It's the Jewish vote that at this point still favors Barack Obama, as it did very heavily in 2008. And he would like to do that. Also, he had a lot of donors there with him in Israel, led by Sheldon Adelson, who is an enormous donor, first to Newt Gingrich, and now has said he would spend $100 million, $100 million as one donor to try to make Mitt Romney to the next president, and who is a huge supporter of Netanyahu and also of Israel in general. So, yeah, he's got political reasons for doing this, but if he is going to be president, it's going to be very difficult for him to even pose as some kind of objective observer or, as you said, a negotiator.
Well, the good news, I guess, is that now he's back in the United States. He still has another week of campaigning while the Olympics are going on. Of course, the Olympics end on Sunday, August 12th, and our guess has been from the beginning that that's the week, starting Monday the 13th, when we might hear news of a running mate. Look, ultimately, I don't know what this foreign trip means as far as the ratings. We did see Quinnipiac, New York Times, CBS poll out this week that showed President Obama with 6-point leads in the swing states of Florida and Ohio, an 11-point lead in Pennsylvania, and that's good. We kept talking about the bad months, mostly about economics, that Obama was having in like May and June. July seems to be Obama's good month, bad month for Romney, but a running mate could change things, at least for the short term.
It's probably easier to say that July has been a rough month for Mitt Romney than to say it was a good month for Barack Obama. He just got somebody else out in front to catch the flak for
That's
a
true.
Little while. The economy doesn't seem to be improving. The growth number for the second quarter was 1.5%. The jobs numbers are still terribly disappointing. And it's not clear where the relief's going to come from. Things aren't getting better in Europe. They had hoped that maybe that crisis would begin to resolve itself
before the
election. The crisis over the euro, the crisis over the debts of Spain and Greece and some of the other countries. Now that doesn't seem to be getting resolved. There's every reason to think we're going to be in this economic slump well through the election, and many fundamental numbers suggest that the president just can't get reelected with this weak an economy. So there's every reason to wonder why President Obama hasn't fallen even further, and maybe the main reason he hasn't fallen even further is that people haven't really warmed up to Mitt Romney.
That's exactly right. If we looked at the polls, if you looked at the confidence in the economy, the confidence in the economic future, it's bad news for Barack Obama. But if you look at the likability factor, and of course, you know, we were always made fun of that, who do you want to have a beer with? But it's more than that. I think that the polls show that who has the same empathy that you do, who feels the way you do, who speaks for people like you, Barack Obama has far higher numbers than Mitt Romney.
That surprises me, given the fact that you've got nearly half the country, or literally in some polls, 50% or more of the country saying they disapprove of his handling of his job.
The historic fact for presidential campaigns is that by Labor Day, that's when the vast majority of American voters start to pay attention to the campaigns. Of course, the debates come on in October. Just go back to 1988. This time in 1988, Michael Dukakis had a huge lead over Vice President George Bush coming out of the Democratic Convention in Atlanta, and Dukakis wound up losing 40 out of 50 states in November. So, again, things can change, minds can change, and, of course, if you're Mitt Romney, you hope minds can change.
Absolutely. You know, in 88, 92, the convention seemed to matter. It seemed to matter what Michael Dukakis did. It seemed to matter what George H.W. Bush did at the convention in 1988, the famous no taxes,
read my lips
pledge. It seemed to matter in 1992, what Bill Clinton did at that particular convention and the extreme right turn that the Republicans seemed to take.
With Pat Buchanan and the culture wars.
Those all seem to matter. It's a little harder to see how the conventions have mattered since that time. It's a little harder to see how it mattered in 96 or 2000 and so forth. You can make a case, I suppose, for the Barack Obama convention in 2008, but I don't think that really changed much. It was just a very well-staged coronation of Barack Obama.
And you could also make a case that for a brief shining moment, the Republicans did have a convention moment in 2008 with Sarah Palin's very exciting speech. That high note of Sarah Palin didn't last that long because of the Katie Couric and the other problems that we learned about Sarah Palin. But again, for that brief shining moment, the convention did give McCain the lift that he wanted, but it didn't last.
So here's the payoff question. Do you see anything coming in either of the two conventions this summer that's likely to be that kind of event for either party?
Well, I don't, because first of all, it's coming late in the summer. The Republicans are the last week of August. The Democrats in Charlotte, the immediate immediate following week, which is a Labor Day week, you know, people may be coming back from vacation. They may not be focusing. Usually when you have an incumbent president, as you have with Barack Obama, there's not much expected. But you do have some new faces who will be introduced in Charlotte that, while it may not affect Barack Obama in November, but could say good things about the Democratic Party's future down the line.
That's right. The first keynote address at a Democratic convention by a Hispanic will be given by Julian Castro, who is the 37-year-old mayor of San Antonio, Texas, a rising star in the Democratic Party, certainly. And we're also going to see Elizabeth Warren, the Senate candidate in Massachusetts, introduce Bill Clinton. I vaguely remember Bill Clinton. He was some kind of Democratic official here in town.
He was some kind. Oh, he sure was.
Not too long ago. And then Bill Clinton is going to place in nomination the name of the incumbent President Obama, which is, some people think, going to be the speech to watch.
Well, of course, remember when Bill Clinton put into the nomination of Michael Dukakis in 1988, he started the speech, I think, on August 17th,
87.
October, and then he ended late October.
In conclusion,
big
round of applause. One of the great moments of convention
but
history.
But look, you know, Bill Clinton...
sure put Mike Dukakis right over the top in November, too, didn't it?
Everybody's talking about how Julian Castro is all about winning the Latino vote. Look, I think it's really about the future of the Democratic Party. When Barack Obama was the keynote speaker in 2004, it wasn't about getting the black vote. It was about showcasing some rising star. Julian Castro may be the future of the Democratic Party in Texas because, of course, you know, you haven't had a statewide winner there since 94.
Is that 1894?
Exactly. Well, nobody since, and I'm not hedging, but Lloyd Benson.
Benson and Hedges.
But Lloyd Benson, 1988, was the last Senate winner there. So this could be about the future of the Democratic Party. And certainly Elizabeth Warren, who, if Barack Obama doesn't excite the base of the Democratic Party, Elizabeth Warren certainly does.
All right. And one other thing about the base of the Democratic Party and the future of the Democratic Party, the platform of the Democratic Party is apparently going to include a platform plank saying, "We, the Democratic Party, approve of gay marriage."
Well, you know, President Obama evolved to that position in May.
Yeah, and just this year.
Yes, and that allowed the rest of the party, which I think was way ahead of him on that position. But I think the Republicans welcome that challenge. They say, you want to put that in your plank? We'll campaign on that, and we'll see who's the winner. And speaking of Hispanics and Latinos at the convention, my guess is that since Mitt Romney is having trouble, do I want to have Sarah Palin? Do I want to have Newt Gingrich? Do I want to have Ron Paul speak? Ted Cruz, the guy, and we'll talk about that in a second, but Ted Cruz, who won this amazing comeback victory this week in Texas for Kay Bailey Hutchinson's seat for the Republican nomination, he's Marco Rubio-like, and he could be what the Republicans put forward as a new future of the party at their convention in Tampa.
I expect we'll see both Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio in generous and prominent roles at the Republican convention. What else could make the Republican convention really exciting?
You could have a keynote speech that gets everybody to their feet.
Maybe that would be Chris Christie?
That's what the guess is, Chris Christie, you know, and he certainly can do it. The reason he would probably not wear well as a vice presidential candidate is probably the same exact reason why he should be the keynoter. He loves taunting the Democrats, and that's what a keynoter does better than anybody else. Although when you think of 2004, Barack Obama, it was not a taunting speech. It was really a One America type speech that probably fit the time. And, of course, we know how John Kerry did in November.
And, of course, the other, you know, element of surprise that we still have before the Republican convention is the naming of the actual vice president. I still feel like it's going to be Rob Portman.
I agree.
Although you do hear people saying Tim Pawlenty's still in the running
others. Paul Ryan's name has come up a lot lately.
His name keeps coming back up. Marco Rubio keeps coming back up. But I believe that it has been decided, and I believe it's Rob Portman, and I think that he fits exactly what Mitt Romney wants in a vice presidential candidate. And I think he'll probably be pretty good in the role, and I think he's going to get a lot of great press.
I do, too. But just as we saw the impatience we saw in Texas, that David Dewhurst, the establishment choice for the Senate in Texas, was not exciting enough and Ted Cruz was more exciting, you wonder if Rob Portman will be okay. Ultimately, I don't think it's going to matter what the Tea Party has to say after the convention. They either want Barack Obama or they want Mitt Romney, and that's the end of it.
Easy choice for them.
Exactly. But I kind of think that they want new, they want exciting, they want fresh, and you know, Rob Portman is not exciting. He may be fresh, and, you know.
I think he's a new face in the sense that, sure, he's another slice of white bread, if you will, with Mitt Romney. I mean, he's a son of some privilege. He is an Ivy League trained, you know, first class numerical mind. He was the head of the Office of Management and Budget, and he is, you know, seen as somebody who has a high degree of intellectual intelligence. Now, whether or not he has the kind of empathy with voters that we've been finding missing in Mitt Romney is another question.
Although the way you just described Rob Portman, you can describe Ted Cruz the same way. Harvard educated, a great debater. He went to Princeton. I mean, he worked in the Bush White House. He clerked for Rehnquist. We're talking about Ted Cruz, the new nominee in Texas. I mean, he has also these academic excellence.
All right. All my efforts to keep you from talking about Ted Cruz and make you talk about something else on some other level have clearly been unavailing.
Well, it's exciting.
It is exciting, and it was pretty exciting on Tuesday night when Ted Cruz counted up the votes and had easily beaten Lieutenant Governor. And I emphasize that title because it's so important in the Texas state government.
It was far more important than
the governor. David Dewhurst. He'd licked him. He'd really let him have it. He'd really walloped him. And this is what he had to say to the wildly enthusiastic crowd.
We are witnessing a great awakening.
Well, that's pretty intense stuff.
No, wait. He's going to say some more.
Oh, sorry.
Millions of Texans, millions of Americans are rising up to reclaim our country, to defend liberty, and to restore the Constitution.
Okay. And you can understand why the Tea Party is excited about this guy. Not only does he have all these credentials, conventional credentials, if you will, but he is right on all of their issues and he is pushing hard for the Tea Party consciousness.
First of all, he was born in Canada. That was interesting. I don't think everybody knows that.
All right. So that eliminates him as a member of the ticket in
Except his mother is American. So I don't know what that...
He was born in Canada. I think that's a problem.
I think it's a problem, too. But here's another thing. His father fought for Fidel Castro, not Batista. As a matter of fact, his father was imprisoned and tortured by Batista. They left Cuba not to escape Castro. They left Cuba to escape Fulgencio Batista. This is a little footnote here, too, but if elected, and of course, he's almost certainly to be elected. There's still no Democratic strength in Texas. There will now be three Cuban-Americans in the Senate, along with Marco Rubio and Bob Menendez of New Jersey.
Okay, so we don't have any suspense about Texas in November, but it was an exciting week in Texas. Another bad week for Rick Perry, who had supported Dewhurst. And just one year ago, he was getting into the presidential race and vaulting to the head of the polls. Rick Perry was, in some people's mind, the clear winner, the clear cream of the crop in this Republican presidential field. Today, he's down at well below 50% approval in Texas, and can't even get his lieutenant governor the nomination to the United States.
Do you know that not long ago at the Texas State Republican Convention, when Rick Perry mentioned the name of David Dewhurst, he was booed? So I wonder that great aura of Rick Perry in Texas as a giant killer, you know, the strongest, the most popular Republican in the state. I mean, look, 2014 is a long way away, but I wonder what Rick Perry's future looks like in a party that has really moved much more to the right.
Another state where there is a primary for the United States Senate and where the differing wings of the Republican Party each have their own champion is the state of Missouri.
Right. It's the next Tuesday, August 7th. It's the Republican primary to get an opponent to Claire McCaskill. Now, all three candidates, Sarah Steelman, John Brunner, and Congressman Todd Akin, polls show that all three will beat Claire McCaskill in November, but all three are very conservative, all are hoping to be the new Tea Party favorite in Missouri.
Sarah Steelman seems to me to have the Tea Party sound down more in her presentation.
Yeah, she doesn't have as much money. She's run for governor before. She's a former state treasurer. She's very good on the stump. Todd Akin, though, seems to have more of the, again, establishment credentials, establishment endorsements. And while I kind of think Todd Akin at one time was the clear front runner, I thought David Dewhurst could lose in Texas either. So, you know, it's strange. But here it's a three-way race. And just like nobody saw Deb Fischer coming out of the weeds in Nebraska, you know, I don't know who's going to win.
There are no weeds, by the way, in Nebraska.
No weeds, no?
No. She was coming out of the cornfield. Hmm. It's not enough water for them.
Well, really?
No.
Huh. And just to follow, 1 week, another Republican primary of note, August 14th in Wisconsin. I don't know who the conservative favorite is, but I do know that whoever the Republican nominee is, the Tea Party does not want it to be Tommy Thompson, the former governor.
Who only won the governorship four times and was just a complete juggernaut in general elections in Wisconsin, but may not get the nomination of the Republican Party in this 2012 year.
And I think that's one of the reasons why there was a big surprise this week in Ohio with Steve LaTourette. He's a congressman from Ohio, first elected in 1994, close confidant of Speaker John Boehner. He announced, now his primary is way behind
already
him.
Nominated.
Yeah, he's a nomination. He was a clear favorite to win re-election in for a 10th term in November. He just said this week, you know, something, well, officially he's complaining about committee assignments, but he said that the toxic atmosphere is just not worth it. We heard that from Olympia Snowe, from some other Republicans, some other Democrats too, Joe Lieberman, Ben Nelson, moderate to centrist Democrats.
Said, all leaving.
They're all leaving, and I think the surprise about LaTourette was that, as you say, he already won the nomination. He was a clear favorite in November, and he just didn't want to go through it again.
Congress, of course, is giving us one more week of demonstration of why all those people want to leave. Here it is, the worst drought we've had in many, many years in the United States, and this Congress can't pass a farm bill. Now, usually the farm bill was the biggest compromise bipartisan deal that went through every 5 years, and it was an opportunity for people to work across the aisle, and one hand would wash the other. That's exactly the kind of Washington Tea Party doesn't like, and that's exactly the kind of function that this Congress can't bring off anymore. And so this Congress goes out for another 5-week recess, during which time we'll have the two national political conventions. Congress will come back in September, around the 10th, and try to get a few more things done, try to at least push off the decisions that they have to make with respect to the nation's finances, to taxing and spending decisions, and just essentially limp through to the election. They really aren't going to try to accomplish anything between now and November, and that's a remarkable admission on the part of any Congress.
Ron, before we go, we often end the podcast in a passing, and worth mentioning this week, Gore Vidal, never elected to anything.
But he was a candidate.
He was a candidate twice in 1960. He ran for Congress in the Hudson Valley in New York State. He advocated the recognition of Red China in a very Republican district, lost to the very famous J. Ernest Wharton.
Is that how J. Ernest Wharton got his start?
He was already an incumbent. And he also ran in, this is 1960, he also ran 1982 in California for the Senate, lost to Jerry Brown in the primary.
And speaking of contests that Gore Vidal engaged in politics, were the political debates and dueling commentaries that he had with William F. Buckley at the conventions in 1968.
There's a classic scene where ABC News had the two of them as commentators, and as the police are battling protesters outside the convention, William F. Buckley is saying good things about the Chicago cops. So Gore Vidal calls him a pro-crypto Nazi, and it gets really ugly from there.
If it is a novelty in Chicago, that is too bad. But I assume that the point of the American democracy is you can express any point of view you want. Shut up a minute.
No, I won't. And some people were pro-Nazi, and the answer is that they were well-treated by people who ostracized them, and I'm for ostracizing people who egg on other people to shoot American Marines and American soldiers.
The only sort of pro-crypto-Nazi I can think of is yourself. Failing that,
Let's stop calling names.
So I think we can see that American political discourse has deteriorated terribly since those lofty heights of 1968.
You're absolutely right, jerk.
Kiss my
And that's it. For
no,
this.
That's my line. And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving. And, and for the moment, I will also be Ken Rudin. Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
And I get sick when I'm around. I can't stand to be. Everything about you.
some say I